Well, thank you, Mr. Williams. Good morning to everyone. Let's see, it's just afternoon in Newfoundland, since they're an hour and a half ahead of us, so it's just around noon there. So good afternoon to those of you further to the east. Let me add my welcome to our sister congregation in St. John's, Newfoundland, viewing this service live today for the first time. Well, not quite live. I'm told there's a 40-second delay. So if I say anything that's not quite appropriate, I expect the Mr. Smith on this side of the transmission to delete it before Mr. Smith on the other side of the transmission hears it. We plan to continue this pattern each second Sabbath of the month when we have the Cleveland service at 10 a.m., which is at 11:30 in Newfoundland. We used to, years ago living in Canada, the broadcast times for shows would often note the difference. We would hear that such and such a show was going to be broadcast at 8 o'clock, 8:30 in Newfoundland. So the half-hour time difference is there from the Atlantic time zone, an hour and a half from us in the east. The next service then that we'll broadcast will be the second Sabbath of January, which I believe will be the 13th, if my memory serves me correctly, January 13th. I think it's only fitting that our contact people on both ends of this first webcast from Cleveland to St. John's are apparently related. Mr. David Smith, the elder in St. John's, has the phone number of Mr. Chris Smith in Cleveland in case he needs to make contact. So if the Smiths start talking, we know that something's not going through as it should be. Mr. Pavlik and I, Matt or Matthew, whichever you prefer, did not collaborate on subjects today, but I am amazed at how tightly they do interweave. That's not uncommon, as most of you know from many years of experience in the church. And this past week, as many of you know who are local here, my wife Janelle and I were visiting with family in the Los Angeles area. My stepmother is 94. My mother died when I was 11, and my dad remarried when I was not quite 15. My dad has been gone now for over 25 years, between 25 and 26 years, but my stepmother's 94. She lives in the Sunland, Shadow Hills area of the Los Angeles Basin with her daughter Allie, my stepsister, and her husband Dwayne and their son Ben. Their daughter Jessica is married and lives in San Diego. We try to visit every winter when the airfares are reasonable right after Thanksgiving. There's quite a dip in prices. We anticipated another pleasant family visit this time, as we've had before. And it started that way, with the exception that Ben, our nephew, had not been feeling well for about 3 or 4 days before our arrival on Sunday. Wondered if he had kidney stones due to the pain in his side. But he was kind of working through that when we arrived. But during the night Monday and early Tuesday morning, things changed. Many of you will have seen the news and some of the shocking photographs coming from the area, even visible from space with the satellites, the shuttle, some of the shots that are being reviewed and seen down here. There's one particularly graphic cell phone video that was widely circulated on Facebook showing traffic moving slowly south on Interstate 405 past the Getty Center Art Museum exit, with the entire hillside on the east side of the freeway appearing to be ablaze on the left of the person taking the shot. We drove past it Thursday morning on our way to the Los Angeles Airport, International Airport, LAX, and the entire section was scorched. Although the fires were mostly out at that point, some small spots we could see were still smoking a little bit near the top of the hill. By 9 a.m. Pacific time on Tuesday, our son Richard, who has worked at the corporate headquarters of Nationwide Insurance for almost 20 years, told us that the estimate for the claims for his company alone by 9 a.m. Tuesday had already topped the $1 billion mark from this one incident. One company, less than 15 hours from the onset of the first fire, the Thomas Fire in Ventura, and it had already, the estimates were already over $1 billion. They were having meetings all day Thursday this week. He was going to have to be in the office basically for about 11 hours from 8 until 7 o'clock Thursday night, all restructuring and talking and gauging the impact. He's on the corporate marketing strategy planning team, gauging the impact of the claims just from this one incident, the Southern California fires at this time. The devastation continues with new fires in rural San Diego County and Riverside counties. They're calling that the Lilac Fire. That was reported yesterday. And our nephew Ben, well, Ben had to go to the hospital Wednesday evening, only to find that he has a perforated appendix with an abscess that is so far containing the poisons in the sac. But the location, which is too close to his intestines, makes surgery a risky option right now. So he has been released last night to go home to treat it with a pretty stiff regimen of antibiotics to try to corral it that way. Where will it end? Where will it end? One of the members here in Cleveland sent us an email while we were there visiting, saying that he was sorry that a trip designed to be pleasant and relaxing and a break from normal routine had turned out to be so turbulent. That was his word. You know, sometimes, as you heard in the sermonette today, we all realize, or should, that is simply the way life is. The whole point of the sermonette was, sometimes time and chance can happen to God's people too. And as Mr. Pavlik said, maybe that's the hardest trial of all to deal with, because it doesn't seem to fit into either of the other two categories that we might understand a little bit better. The question is, how do we deal with it? You had one very good answer given in the first message today. Several thoughts sprang to mind over the last few days while we were visiting. The wildfires in Southern California have two main causes, which when combined can prove highly combustible. They are wind and dry conditions, or extremely low humidity. They can then lead, with the smallest spark, to a terrible conflagration of fire. The Santa Ana winds are a known phenomenon of the area. They form out over the desert areas to the east of the Los Angeles Basin. And there's a reason it's called the basin. It's ringed by mountains, and so sometimes when you get smoke like this that fills it up, there's nowhere for it to go. The Ventura fire, the northern areas of it near the town of Ojai, there's just nowhere for the smoke to go at this point. And the fire danger is one part of it, but the smoke, the toxicity of the smoke danger is another part of it. People are being told to stay indoors if they can at all. But those winds form out in the basins and come into the basin from the desert areas to the east. And while they're not sustained winds like a hurricane, they can occasionally gust to hurricane strength. There were some gusts reported while we were there in excess of 80 miles an hour, about 130 kilometers an hour. Hurricane strength is typically considered to be a minimum of 74 miles per hour. That's about 118 kilometers an hour. These Santa Ana winds typically die down within about 48 hours, usually. But they can, as they've been doing since Monday, last significantly longer, or they can die down only to spring up again. In order to deal with the danger posed by the Santa Ana winds, which can be hot or cold, that's some mistaken impression some people have, that they're automatically hot winds. They don't have to be. They can be cold. The main factor is the wind speed and the extremely low humidity. Those are the problems. People are urged to be prepared to flee or evacuate if that's the only way to avoid personal disaster. Houses can be rebuilt. And possessions, although maybe dear to us, are, after all, just physical things. People cannot be brought back to life, not short of God's direct hand to resurrect. And this past week, the Los Angeles Fire Department had numerous public service warnings and explanations urging people to pay heed, to listen. They encapsulated it with a familiar three-word phrase. Their phrase was ready, set, go. Residents were told when the danger threatened to have their cars packed with the basics that they would need or the things that they absolutely had to protect. That was the ready phase. They were told to be of a mindset that was watchful and able to move almost immediately if the need arose. That was set. We experienced all those things Tuesday night as we debated whether we should evacuate or not. Their home was not in the mandatory evacuation area, but it was in an area that was closed off coming below up the hill, up a road called Sunland Avenue, Sunland Boulevard. And if you went out beyond the neighborhood, you couldn't get back in unless you knew of back roads and back ways, which they did, as I explained to all of you in an email earlier this week. So we had to be ready. We packed again Tuesday night. And we basically slept with one eye open, as they say, in case we heard the noise, in case we heard the police bullhorns outside saying, go, 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 go. But we didn't hear those things. People were told that when their areas came under mandatory evacuation orders, that they should not stay behind, thinking they could somehow fight the fire and win. That's the go phase. You got to get out. And we were awakened early Tuesday morning by sounds in the house between 4:30 and 5 of some of the members of the church in the area there arriving at Duane and Allie's home because they had been told to evacuate. They had to get out. Now, does any of this sound like it could connect to our lives in the calling God's given us? And again, I point you back to the sermonette on a very closely related topic. I think it does. Christ's instruction in the Olivet prophecy illustrates it all very well. So turn to Matthew 25. Matthew 25, we'll start with a very familiar section, the parable of the 10 virgins. Verse 1. Then the kingdom of heaven shall be likened to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Now, 5 of them were wise and 5 were foolish. Those who were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them. But the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps. But while the bridegroom was delayed, they all slumbered and slept. And at midnight a cry was heard, "Behold, the bridegroom is coming. Bridegroom is coming. Go out to meet him." And then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." They hadn't prepared. They weren't ready. They weren't packed and ready to go. They all slumbered and slept. We felt that way Tuesday night. We slept. We'd been so exhausted from the whole day that we all slept pretty soundly. But we were ready to get up and go if we had to at a moment's notice. But the wise answered, saying, "No, lest there should not be enough for us and you. But rather go to those who sell and buy for yourselves." And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came. And those who were ready went in with him to the wedding, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But he answered and said, "Assuredly, I say to you, I do not know you. Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming." That is just as true now as it was when Matthew recorded those words, spoken by our Savior. Does this sound familiar? Well, it should, brethren, because I think this is the ready phase. The virgins, the 10 of them, all slept, it says, but 5 of them were packed and ready. They took oil with their vessels, with their lamps. They were ready, should a need arise, to go. And when the call came, basically it seems like in the middle of the night, they were ready. They were able to depart. Then there's the next step, back up to chapter 24 of Matthew. Verse 36, "But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in the days before the flood they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. Then 2 men will be in the field. One will be taken, the other left. 2 women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and the other left. Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Who then is a faithful servant, faithful and wise servant, whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. I'd liken that one to the set step. Ready, set. We're doing when Jesus Christ chooses to return. When our time of testing ends, for example, as it does for some who've served long and faithfully. You heard the announcement about Mr. Burke McNair, someone that I knew a little bit, worked with off and on at some connections, going clear back to when I was in college and working in the old church administration department in the Worldwide Church of God. He and his brother Carl would come in and collaborate with some of us who worked in the financial areas. That's a long time ago. He would have been 86 later this month. We were exactly 20 years apart in age. I think we had the same birthday even. Time ends at some point. Of course, there's the last step. Also here in Matthew 24, and verse 12. It says, because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. Mull that over for a moment. Hold your place here, because we'll come back. But turn to 1 John chapter 2. And verse 15. John writes, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, is not of the Father, but it's of the world. And the world is passing away in the lust of it, but he who does the will of God abides forever. You have to ask yourself a question. Here's the contrast for you and for me spiritually. We cannot be so glued to the things of this world that we would attempt to stay when we should go. That's certainly true in a fire situation. Sometimes people are attached. Maybe they have beautiful homes. Some of those lovely homes on the mountaintops out there are now nothing but piles of rubble. Wonderful view. They were interviewing one lady who had lost her home. And the interviewer said something about, I'm sorry, so sorry that you've lost your view. And she said, oh, I haven't lost my view. I've lost my home. The view is still here. She had a point. She had at least had a sense of humor about it. Basically, she was saying, I can rebuild if I want to. But we have to understand what's important. We cannot get our priorities upside down. So back to Matthew 24. To complete the thought. Matthew 24, we'll pick it up again in verse 15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Well, in this case, people were fleeing from the mountains, from the higher areas where the fires were spreading. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. There comes a point where it's too dangerous to go back. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. That's the point. There is a time when it's time to go. And so right here in Matthew 24 and 25, in the words of Jesus Christ in the Olivet Prophecy, we have that entire encapsulation of ready, set, go. The threat, brethren, is real. I'm talking spiritually now. And again, you heard about it already in the sermonette. These two messages have really dovetailed today in an astonishing manner. The threat was real out west, too, and still is for those in many areas of Southern California. Let's take a look, though, at the part about the conditions that lead to the wildfires in the first place. Remember, I talked about that. First of them, in time order, is actually the problem of dry conditions. That's the real problem, first of all. Normally, this season of the year could be a partial rainy time in Southern California. For some reason, there's almost always a gap in late December, early January. Those of you who love to watch the Rose Parade, we worked at it when we were college students. The viewing stands were set up on the college grounds. That was the way the students earned money for field trips and things like that. We, as a student body, even 45 years ago and thereabouts, we routinely would earn $20,000 to $25,000 in income from selling programs, from selling refreshments, from various things that parking. People were parking in the days before the auditorium was built. There was nothing but lawn surrounding those sculptures of the egrets. They would park cars all over those lawns. You'd look out from the hall of administration toward the student center and see a vast parking lot on the grass. People would pull up and say, "You want me to park on that beautiful lawn?" "Yes, go ahead. Yes, go. That's what it's for. We'll, gardeners will take care of it afterwards." But at any rate, the thing is, brethren, there are problems in the whole area, and the dry conditions are the problem. You almost never saw rain on the Rose Parade for some reason. Only two or three times in its more than 100-year history has it been postponed by rain. But that season of the year can be and should be rainy off and on. November, very early December, late January, February, it should be kind of wet sometimes. It hasn't been this year for a long time. Most of California right now, Southern California, is very arid. Northern, too. The fires earlier this year, as you know, in the wine-growing areas. Rains generally come on a seasonal basis. And the tremendous bounty of the fruits and vegetables that are grown in the Central Valley there, it's often aided by man through irrigation. The soils are rich, but if they're dry, the richness doesn't do anybody any good. Think about what that means to us in spiritual terms. What is humanity without God? You heard some advice in the sermonette today. Only two ways to go through a trial, whatever brought it on, with God or without God. That's it. What is humanity without God? Aren't we also pretty arid? Pretty much desert-like conditions? Aren't we pretty dried up and lifeless without God? What understanding of God's purpose can we have unless God Himself intervenes in our minds to open those minds and puts in the ability to access His wisdom and His knowledge? Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 2, a very familiar section about how this works. 1 Corinthians 2, verse 7, it says, "But we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, the hidden wisdom," excuse me, "the hidden wisdom which God ordained before the ages for our glory, which none of the rulers of this age knew. For had they known, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. But as it is written, 'Eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor have entered into the heart of man, the things which God has prepared for those who love Him.' But," it says, "God has revealed them to us through His Spirit. For the Spirit searches all things, even the deep things of God. For what man knows the things of a man except the spirit of the man which is in him? Even so, no one knows the things of God except the Spirit of God." That's the only way it can work. That's the way that our minds can be activated to understand spiritual principles. Otherwise, you can't do it. We've talked before in past sermons, for example, the concept of holy time. Like, this is holy time. How would you determine that using the physical senses? How would you determine, as I mentioned in a sermon recently, which time is ordinary and which time is holy? The time itself seems all the same. There is no physical way to determine that. Only when God shows it to us through His Spirit, through the pages of His Word. And it's here. How many copies of the Bible are in existence throughout the world? Millions, billions probably, in various languages. How many understand that? Not very many. A few thousand. A few thousand at best. Maybe not even 100,000. Most likely not. Who knows? Here's the comparison in 1 Corinthians 2. Dry versus well-watered. Arid versus productive. Knowledgeable versus unaware. Ignorant of God's devices. Ignorant is not a pejorative term. It just describes something you don't know. We are all ignorant about many things. We don't know them. And that's the way it is. John chapter 4, Gospel of John. John 4 and verse 5. So he came to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, sat thus by the well. It was about the sixth hour, right around noon. A woman of Samaria came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. Then the woman of Samaria said, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." Jesus answered, and he said to her, "If you knew the gift of God, and who it is that says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." The woman said, "Sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where then do you get that living water?" As so many times happened in Jesus Christ's ministry, he would be talking to people, and he would be talking at a level they just could not access. They could not understand. He's talking about God's Spirit, and she says, "You don't have a bucket." It's kind of amusing on one level, and it ought to teach us something. "Are you greater," verse 12, "than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as well as his sons and his livestock?" Well, there's a whole discussion in that about the Samaritans not being descended from Jacob, but that's for another time and another message. "Jesus answered and said to her, 'Whoever drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into eternal life.'" That's nothing physical. That's obviously a reference to God's Spirit. We understand this. We understand what that spiritual living water can give us. What kind of thirst it can slake. What kind of parched lips and mouth and dried out tongue it can moisten. We understand those things. The world does not, cannot. John chapter 7. John 7 and verse 37. On the last day, that great day of the feast, we understand that now generally to most likely have been day 7 of the Feast of Tabernacles, not what we can commonly call the last great day, the eighth day. That was probably in chapter 8 when Jesus was returning to the temple to teach. But in John 7:37, on the last day, that great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried out, saying, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the Scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water." But this he spoke concerning the Spirit, which those believing in him would receive, because the Holy Spirit, for the Holy Spirit was not yet given, because Jesus was not yet glorified. It would happen, as we know, beginning on the day of Pentecost that year when the New Testament church began. That's what he was talking about when he spoke about living water. When he talked about the kind of water that you would drink and you would never thirst again. He's talking about God's Spirit. This is the comparison. God's Spirit can prevent arid conditions spiritually. That's the point. The first of those danger conditions, arid conditions, God's Spirit can prevent it spiritually, so that we're not so dried out and desiccated spiritually where we don't have the wherewithal to battle the trials that will come. We are in far less danger from a terrible spiritual conflagration if we are drinking deeply of the living water, the kind that means you never go thirsty again. So even if the sparks of life in Satan's world fly onto us, as we heard earlier today, they sometimes do. They sizzle and they are drowned in the powerful healing, washing effect of God's truth. Turn to Ephesians chapter 5. In the midst of a section on marriage, the comparison is made of husbands modeling themselves after Jesus Christ as the perfect husband. And in verse 26 of Ephesians 5, it talks about how we as husbands are to love our wives just as Christ loves the church and gives himself to protect and be providing for her. It says in verse 26 that he, Christ, might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself, a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. That's the effect of God's Spirit. The effect of drying up arid spiritual conditions. Metaphorically, in the future world, the new heavens and the new earth, look at how that's described in Revelation 22. In spiritual terms that we can't fully understand now, but we will see if we are faithful and go through these trials with God, as Mr. Pavlik stated. Revelation 22, look at the future. How is it described? He showed me, verse 1, a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding from the throne of God and of the Lamb. In the middle of its street and on either side of the river was the tree of life, which bore 12 fruits, each tree yielding its fruit every month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. And there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him. They shall see his face, his name shall be on their foreheads. That's the picture of the future. And it's all tied into this living water, the water of life that nourishes, in this case, the tree of life, so that it brings forth fruits, it says. So God has an answer for dry conditions. Are we being spiritually irrigated? That's what we need to ask. Next, in general time order of the danger, would be wind. Wind. We might make the comparison of the storms of life. Jesus did. Turn to Matthew chapter 7. Matthew 7, toward the end of the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 7, 24. Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat on that house. And it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. That would be the people who go through trials with God. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell. And great was its fall. In this case, the wind is part of the package of the storm. And it's the last element that Jesus Christ mentions here that actually completes the destruction. The wind is what finally completed the destruction of those who weren't built solidly on the rock. It had no effect in dislodging those who were solidly locked in to God. And that's where you and I need to be. What about us? Matthew 14. Matthew 14, another story about wind, because that is, of course, the second element. Matthew 14, 23, and when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now when evening came, he was alone there. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. And in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus came to them, or went to them, walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It's a ghost," and they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." You know, I have to ask, I wonder, maybe we can talk to Peter in the resurrection, and I'm going to ask him, "Peter, was there ever a time when you blurted something out and you said, 'Oh, what have I done? Why did I say that?'" I don't know. There's all a reason for it all, but I'm kind of curious. So Christ said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, and it was boisterous this past week sometimes when we were out in Los Angeles area, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. Then those who were in the boat came and worshipped him, saying, "Truly you are the Son of God." It's interesting, isn't it? Despite all of his explanations, it was something like this that got the point home. When you're in a dangerous situation because of the wind, you ache for the sound of nothing. The sound of nothing. In very wet seasons, the Santa Ana winds are mostly just an annoyance. Oh, they blow hard. But if conditions are well lubricated, well humidified, they don't cause as much trouble. Oh, they can knock down some trees and might hit a power line. But you don't have the extreme risk of fire. And even if somebody starts a fire, and if the embers blow, if it hits a soggy, wet, muddy field, nothing happens. One of the steps that many homeowners were taking out there was to climb up on top of their roofs with garden hoses and just soak the roof as much as they could, because that's where the danger could come from. The nearest house to my sister's and brother-in-law's place that burned to the ground was only a mile and a half away from them. As you're leaving here, if you drive out along Center Road to the east, that's about the distance from here to Conrad's, the tire repair shop, the car engine repair place. It's less than that to our home here, as some of you know. a little bit more than that to our home. The distance is less than to drive to our home. We need to think about, brethren, what it means to avoid those winds. When conditions are ripe and the Santa Anas blow, they can cause untold hardship, agony, financial loss, even death. It can happen spiritually. Turn to Ephesians 4. Ephesians 4, verse 11. And he himself gave some to be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers, for the equipping of the saints, for the work of ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. And here's the operative part. That we should no longer be children tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine by the trickery of men in the cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting, but speaking the truth in love, we may grow up in all things into Him who is the head, Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies, according to the effective working by which every part does its share, growth of the body for the edifying of itself, causes growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. Brethren, we need to be spiritually mature. Spiritually mature so that the winds of doctrine, as Paul called them, don't blow us off our foundation. We have to be anchored on the rock. Hearkening back to Matthew 7 once more. Turn to Hebrews chapter 5. Hebrews 5 and verse 12. For though by this time you ought to be teachers, we read, you need someone to teach you again the first principles of the oracles of God. And you have come to need milk and not solid food. For everyone who partakes only of milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness, for he's a babe. But solid food belongs to those who are of full age. The margin says mature. That is, those who by reason of use, marginal reference, practice, have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. You can tell them apart. Our world can't tell good and evil apart sometimes. What about the prophets who say, woe to those who call evil good and good evil? They honestly can't tell the difference sometimes. And they talk about, well, this is just as valid a lifestyle as that is a lifestyle. Not by God's word, it's not. And that has to be our guiding light, our guiding and instruction and understanding and where we turn for deepening of wisdom and spiritual conduct. Spiritual immaturity is dangerous because it exposes us to the wind of doctrinal and spiritual instability. We have to be mature. Sometimes we need to be aware of and not get caught up in things that are simply not worth our time spiritually. Have to think about it. We only have so much of that. Turn to James chapter 1. Here's what we need. James 1 verse 4, but let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect, that is mature, again, and complete, lacking nothing. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given to him. Now verse 6, James 1, but let him ask in faith, with no doubting, for he who doubts is like a wave of the sea, driven and tossed by what? By the wind. The wind. The wind has a very disorienting, destabilizing effect on people who aren't solidly anchored in a mature Christian approach. Finally, what is it that causes the catastrophe, the catastrophic roaring wildfires to break out? Well, something may be very small, oven by itself. It may be just a tiny thing. But when conditions are ripe and there's little or no defense, it doesn't take very much. Brethren, you ought to, and I ought to, hear the analogy in that for us spiritually. When the conditions are ripe, it doesn't take much to cause disaster. What comparison is there in God's Word? Turn to Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6. Verse 11. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places. By our analogy today, I'm not just talking about wildfires. That's scary enough. We've now been through them. I haven't been actually in a hurricane, been chased out from places by them. But my wife has now been in four types of disasters. I won't say anything more. I don't think it would be wise or safe. But anyway, she's been in four types of disasters. She's been in them all. She's been in an earthquake. We've both been in earthquakes. We've both been in tornadoes, a tornado right around our home many years ago. She's been in a hurricane. I've been on the edges of one. And now we've been immersed in wildfires. You know, you've heard the expression Calamity Jane. I'm not going to start calling her Calamity Janelle, but you know, whatever. But we've been there. She's been there even more than I have. And it's not pretty. It's not fun. It's not a walk in the park. It's scary. Well, brethren, spiritual can even be more scary. Drop on down further here in Ephesians 6. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all to stand. Stand therefore, having girded your waist with truth, having put on the breastplate of righteousness, having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace. And look at the last step. Above all, taking the shield of faith, with which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. Now that's quite the analogy for our sermon today, for my sermon today, for the analogy we're looking at. The shield of faith. How does it operate? It operates to quench the fiery darts of the wicked one. One of the defenses, if you're far enough away and you're not so close that there's nothing that can be done, is to wet everything down. Wet your roof down, the shingles, soak them. If you've got vegetation in the yard, just turn the hose on it and soak it. You see helicopters fighting the fires with this gigantic scoop basket underneath. They actually drop down into a reservoir. I told Dwayne and Allie, be careful, watch out for your swimming pool out back there, you know, if the reservoir runs dry. They just scoop up this giant catch, and then it's amazing the precision with which they can drop those, you know, those bucketful, I mean, gigantic scoop bag of water on the fires. And there'll be three or four there circling back and forth and back and forth. And you see it turn from black, ugly smoke to white smoke. That's a good sign. Well, can we do that spiritually? How did the fires in Southern California start? Well, they started by embers blowing from other fires. That's how it spreads. Arid conditions, and then the wind, and then there was nothing to quench the fiery darts, the embers. My stepsister and brother-in-law and their family found, as we saw when we drove through the nearby area Wednesday after the worst of the fires in their area, part of the Creek Fire, one of this wasn't the big one, the Thomas Fire, that moved mostly to the west. Like I said, that the one house closest to them that burned to the ground was only a mile and a half from them. An entire area that my brother-in-law normally walks in for exercise. He knows it's 1.8 miles from the house at the furthest extent because his round-trip walk is 3.6 miles. Totally scorched. The dry wash area with a walkway and a bike path just scorched. Everything blackened and gray and ashy, and a tiny little creek still rolling through the bottom of it. It's astonishing. It was a strange sight, this one house. The houses on either side appeared pretty much untouched. And yet this one was nothing but rubble, burned out hulk of rubble, flattened right to the ground. The only thing left standing was the chimney. And the houses on either side still there. That one was completely incinerated. How does that happen? Well, by the combination of all we've spoken of, arid conditions, wind, and then one random fiery dart. That's all it takes. An ember from a fire started who knows how far away, that was blown and landed on that house. And it's too late. Is there a message, brethren, in all this for us? Well, I believe there is. And you've gotten a double dose of it today, I think, in the messages. The fires will come. How will we handle them? Will we perhaps even cause some of them ourselves? You heard a reference to that in the sermonette too. Turn to James chapter 3. Here's an analogy of fire that we need to be aware of. James 3 and verse 1. My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. For we all stumble in many things. If any man does not stumble in word, he's a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body. Is there anybody here who has never spoken out of turn, who's never uttered an unkind word, who has never gotten in trouble with your tongue? Can I see a show of hands? I don't know if any hands are up in St. John's, but there are none up here in Cleveland. Indeed, we put bits in horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. Look also at ships, although they're so large and driven by fierce winds, they're turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. We saw plenty of evidence of that in the last week. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature. And it is set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast and bird or reptile or creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind, but no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. This tongue, it says, it's a fire. How interesting as an analogy. And it sets on fire the course of nature. How many times can things that are said, you know, the old childish little sing-songy, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. That's not true. Words can cause a very great deal of hurt. Sticks and stones and broken bones can heal. Sometimes the effects of words can last for years. Sometimes generations. Pretty scary. This is a challenge, brethren. Can we deal with it? James describes the answer later in this chapter, verse 15, where this wisdom doesn't descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. Where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality, without hypocrisy. Now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Are we peacemakers? Christ asked that of us through the pen of James, and he talked about being a peacemaker in the Sermon on the Mount. How are we doing? There is more. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. First Corinthians 3 and verse 9, Paul says, we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field. You are God's building. Those are all analogies. According to the grace of God, which was given to me as a wise master builder, I've laid the foundation, and another builds on it. But let each one take heed how he builds on it. For no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, if anyone builds on this foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each one's work will become clear, for the day will declare it, because it will be revealed by fire. Trials do come. Sometimes those fiery darts do find a ready bunch of kindling, and they do blow up into a trial. And the fire will test each one's work of what sort it is. If anyone's work which he has built on it endures, he will receive a reward. If his work is burned, he'll suffer loss, but he himself will be saved, yet so as through fire. Sometimes trials do cause partial spiritual damage, but we can still recover. That's the beauty of God's help and the strength of His Spirit. Have you thought about these things this way? The fire will test what we've built. How strong will our construction be? 1 Peter chapter 1. First Peter 1 verse 6, in this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise and honor and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. It will come. Peter tells us it will. Ready, set, go. Turn to Revelation 3. Revelation 3. In verse 18, one of the messages to one of the seven churches, this one to Laodicea, says in verse 18 of Revelation 3, I counsel you, the message from Jesus Christ, to buy from me gold refined in the fire. We're not talking physical gold, 18, 24 karat, or any other kind of vegetable. We're talking about spiritual character. Gold refined in the fire, that you may be rich, spiritually rich, and white garments, that you may be clothed, that the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed. Anoint your eyes with eye salve, that you may see. Buy from me gold refined in the fire. Sometimes character requires testing, tempering, refining. It just is that way. Some of God's precious children here are told they must buy gold refined in the fire to be in God's astounding family. That may be a reference to some even going through the Great Tribulation in order to have the character of God built in their lives. We would all pray and wish and hope that such a path would not be ours. That choice was at least in part up to us. Brethren, the conditions will at times be in place. The fires will at times come. Are we ready for the challenges in our lives spiritually? In California, the wildfires are shifting. In our last conversation with our family there last night about 8 o'clock our time, about 5 o'clock their time, they told us that that day, yesterday, Friday, had actually been very beautiful where they are. The police barricades in the streets have been removed. Those who had to evacuate in that area are either back in their homes. Some of the people who landed in their home on Tuesday morning and awakened us between 4:30 and 5 are either back in their homes already or plan to be by sometime tomorrow. The fires still rage in Ventura, up moving now north along the coast towards Santa Barbara. That fire, the Thomas Fire, has jumped the Pacific Coast Highway, Highway 101, and has burned right down to the Pacific Ocean. New fires were reported yesterday further south. As I said, the Lilac Fire, they're calling it now, in rural areas of San Diego and Riverside counties. It will be a while before they're all contained. It will be longer before the extent of the damage is known, and I suspect our son Richard will have to have more long days of meetings at Nationwide Insurance, as will many of the insurers, before this is all done. It will be even longer before the effects can be dealt with, if ever, in this lifetime. We heard of one sad situation. It's not tragic in terms of human life, but one small ranching operation up on the hill where they weren't able to get their 30 horses out. They were all destroyed. They were all burned. There are things that happen. Our nephew, well, Ben's home, and he hopes the antibiotic regimen works. If it does and the abscess is absorbed harmlessly, they still might want to do an appendectomy if they believe the appendix has been damaged badly enough. If condition worsens, they hope that the abscess, if it grows, would actually push the intestine away from the organ far enough to allow surgery. We'll see. He's certainly not out of the woods yet. Ben is 27 years old. What about you and me? You know the causes, if we talk spiritually. You know the dangers. You know the pattern needed to fight it. Three words left. Ready? Set? Go.